Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I'm here with Roy Snell in what I can only say is one of the most glorious days I've ever seen in June in Minneapolis for this episode of Unfair and Unbalanced, a podcast with Tom Fox and Roy Snell, or Roy Snell and Tom Fox, I can never remember. But we are recording after the U.S. Open, and the U.S. Open had an incident or event that Roy and I thought would be an excellent way to explore several topics around compliance and ethics. So, Roy, first of all, welcome. Thank you for providing me this weather, I think, on the longest day of the year.
It's beautiful. Oh, my gosh. It's the summer solstice.
Summer solstice, and we have a full moon. So
it is.
Strawberry moon on summer solstice, first time in 45 years. So, Sunday, we had Dustin Johnson winning his first major, U.S. Open. But we had a controversy come up where, and only in golf would we have such a controversy, where he self-reported a potential violation because his ball rolled, immediately raised his hand and called a marshal over to make a ruling on the situation. He was on the green and his ball rolled a slight turn. He had not grounded his club, as I understand it. The marshal reviewed the situation, did what you and I would call an investigation, although he talked to Johnson, he talked to his caddy and his partner, and made a ruling that there had been no violation. He would not be assessed a penalty. Nevertheless, the USGA, after the tournament was over, or during the tournament, informed him that it was under review. He could potentially be assessed a penalty. He was indeed assessed a penalty after the tournament was over. He won by 4 strokes, so even with a 1-stroke penalty, it didn't negatively impact, although it certainly could have had it been close. But this, for both of us, brought up several important issues around what do you do when you have an incident? And let me contrast this a little bit, because a couple of years ago we had an incident in the Masters where Tiger Woods was assessed a penalty based upon something someone saw on television and called in the USGA about, and he was assessed a penalty after the round had concluded and he had signed a scorecard which was incorrect. And typically when you sign an incorrect scorecard, you are disqualified. He was not disqualified. He was assessed a penalty and was allowed to continue playing. And the USGA received what I thought was fair criticism for not enforcing the rules. But here it went in a different direction. So maybe why don't you pick it up?
Well, the core of the issue for me was the way they handled the process. People are debating whether or not he caused the ball to move. They're debating whether or not the rules official who was traveling with that twosome, who happened to be the chair of their rules committee, pretty qualified individual, said he didn't have a problem. Some say he should have been, his word should have been final. But the problem I had is that they were made aware of it in the clubhouse. The rules officials watched video on the 12th, when Dustin was on the 12th hole. They came and told him, maybe you got a problem, maybe you don't. They wouldn't tell him really even if they were going to give him the penalty, but they were warning him and they warned the other players out of fairness that there may be a stroke penalty at the end of the tournament. The problem, particularly in golf, is you just got in this guy's head in a major way and they shouldn't be messing with him. It's inappropriate. But I would say even at a higher level that it is believed they knew they were going to assess a penalty. They just handled it somewhat coyly. And the biggest mistake, I believe, is when they knew they were going to assess them the penalty, they should have told them. And it's a loose connection to the philosophy I have that transparency is deemed a bit of a problem in society, that there's not enough. I think we can go overboard. I think we have to be careful. But when you know something is a problem, when you know something is going to happen, I would just come out and tell people right away. This delaying bad information or some sort of discipline or anything, I think you got to make sure you know what you're doing. Dot all the I's, cross all the T's, but make the announcement as soon as possible. This dithering and waiting just compounds problems. And in this case, it just so happened to be it could have negatively affected Dustin Johnson, which it didn't. He actually finished out very strong. And all the other people they told who were chasing him all kind of fell apart. Whether it had anything to do with it, I don't know. But still, the point is, this is the wrong way to handle it. They should have said, we know what we're doing. We're going to assess you a penalty. We'll deal with it when you're done.
Well, I think review of penalties, proposed penalties, and infractions in sports is something that has certainly become more common in football and basketball, to a lesser extent, hockey and baseball. I'm a huge advocate of wanting the umpires, officials, management to get it right.
Yeah.
And I don't really think we're in this day and age you should have to live and die with a call or something that's obviously wrong. So when I see an official in football having to review a play, or in basketball, or even now in baseball where they review certain plays and home runs, I really think that that brings a level of quality and sets an expectation that we're going to do everything to get it right. So why shouldn't the USGA try and do everything in their power to get it right, even if it requires them to take a little bit of time?
Yeah, I think you could debate whether or not that they should have trusted the rules official and made the first call. Matter of fact, I think there's even a rule. I saw it in a tweet, so I didn't see the rules above it and below it. But there's a rule is that the rule official that is traveling with the twosome, decisions are final. But let's assume somehow this can be explained, that they were within the rules to review it five or six hole later. They looked at the video, they had the information, they made a decision and came and told them maybe. I think for the game, they ought to do what you're suggesting. Maybe it was justified to look at it again and overrule the individual, but you have the video. Make the decision or not. The only argument I've heard someone say is that they were going to ask Justin again. They'd already asked him, did you cause the ball to move? The USGA official said, well, we asked him and his answer wasn't definitive enough. The rules official on the whole when it happened asked him and his answer wasn't definitive enough. And I hope we get to talk about the integrity of golf in a second here when we're done with this, because there's some fun stuff there. But this was a case of a fine sport just run amok, in my opinion, in terms of how they handled it.
Well, as I recall, the name of the organization that you're the CEO of is Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics.
Yes.
And I generally think of integrity around the issue of ethics. So it seemed to me it'd be an appropriate discussion about why does golf have a culture that may be unique to any other sport in terms of self-disclosure, self-reporting, and absolute integrity at all times, not enforced from the top. It's enforced from the bottom.
Yeah.
And players will, I think they are the greatest enforcers of that. Why that sport as opposed to other sports that you and I may have competed
in? Well, as a matter of fact, if people flop in basketball and soccer, most of the players spend most of their time on the field grabbing their knee, rolling around. I'm sorry, I'm exaggerating for dramatic effect, but it's just so phony. Their peers think, well, that's part of the game, is to try and fool the official into thinking you got hurt or got fouled or whatever. I don't let it ruin my life. I still like watching these sports, but I find it pretty disgusting. On the other hand, in golf, there could be a guy in the trees, completely away from video and everyone else, and he walks up to finally finds his ball in the brush and accidentally pulls a branch and the ball moves. He's going to run right outside and tell everybody, even though nobody would have ever known. There's countless stories of these guys who could have not said anything. There was a guy who played the wrong ball. He pulled the wrong ball out of his bag. I don't know quite how it was the wrong ball, but he discovered it like a week after the tournament and disqualified himself in the money that he was going to earn. And how your question is how did it get there? It's grassroots, ground up from the beginning of the sport. The people who started playing this decided this is the way it's going to go. And nothing has eroded it over the years. The real question I'd love to have the answer to, and I can't, is how do we get there from here with things that aren't that way? Or what lessons can we learn from them? It just happened. It just it's locked in to their psyche. Interestingly, kind of like locked into some rumored codes that are never spoken in certain groups of people that they won't tell on a particular person in their fraternity or their group. And these cultures, almost said cult, it's almost cult-like. These cultures are developed by the people. Well, you can say this for sure, is that when the culture is developed and created by the people, everyone, then it gets pretty rock solid. I just don't know how to get there from here without a lot of work.
I guess the thing that has always struck me about golf is it's self-enforcing.
Yeah.
And it's certainly one thing for your peers to enforce something on you, but it's a completely different level when you enforce it on yourself. And I was really proud of Johnson for what he did. I disagreed with the outcome. I thought, first of all, I didn't think he caused the ball to move because I didn't think he grounded his club, and I thought that was the rule, and he didn't touch it. Nevertheless, I think it speaks well of golf.
Yeah, you know, if you watch the video of him moving his putter, people are looking, well, he's taking practice swings. He didn't ground the club, but he put the putter behind the ball, didn't touch the grass. Everybody's looking at that. What you just said was what really is interesting is he immediately, what they're not talking about, because they expect it, he immediately pulled his club away from the ball, the grass, the everything, and his almost knee-jerk reaction was his hand went in the air to wave the official over. I mean, it gives me, you know, great pride in that particular game to see that. I mean, I wish there was an easier way to get to that in life. I think they just got lucky. It got started that way. They've committed to it. They've stuck with it. And I wish we could learn from it and use it in business ethics. And, you know, you can. I mean, here's some examples. We've had a couple of problems here. We've had a couple of minor infractions. We buy the use of, we have a photograph library that we have limited use of their photographs in our brochures. And we accidentally used one of their photographs for a way that wasn't permitted in the agreement. And the employee called the company immediately and said, I used this in a publication in a print run that was not appropriate. The damage is done. What do we do? Company had a very nice response. They said, just buy the different package that allows you to use it in that way. Very fair. We immediately wrote a check. And as far as the company was concerned, we were right with the world. And she ran into my office right after she got it all taken care of and said, I messed up and I fixed it. And I, at the next staff meeting, pointed out that she did this and immediately ran into my office. And, you know, we're always going to do the best we can to handle this in the smartest of ways. And I have nothing but praise for her. And I'm not going to get upset that we messed up. It's going to happen. And if you, you know, you have to offset the examples of where people do something people think they're getting away with and leadership doesn't do anything, that's going to head you away from the golf culture. If you run to the employees in a newsletter or verbally or whatever, even give awards to people who fix problems like that. You can't always do this. If there are problems employees create that actually might require disclosure to the enforcement community. I know there's a lot of complexity. I don't want to get into all that. Everybody always heads towards how you can't do this. But there are ways you can do this, and you should do it as often as possible. And it will teach people to do what Justin did, which is his hand went up as fast as he could get it up. That was so cool. And if we could get our people to do that, it'd be a lot easier running these compliance programs.
Let me see if I could change the topic to something really completely different. And you and I have talked about this over the past few weeks, and it's the issue of certification.
Yeah.
The SCCE has a certification program. I have not gone through that certification program. I have been a part of it, though, in terms of providing white papers, webinars, mm-hmm. other articles that mm-hmm. people have used to self-study to become certified under the SEC.
And get credit CEUs for reading the articles. They can get that too.
Yes. So, but I wanted to see if maybe you could explain why SCCE developed this and what it's trying to accomplish with its certification process.
Well, to start from the very beginning, there are credentials people get, doctors, lawyers, accountants with the CPA, that are certainly more onerous credentials. And more exhaustive testing and these sorts of things. But there are probably a couple thousand credentials in this country, medical technologists, lab technicians. Many professions have a certification that involves a process I'll share with you in a minute. And we did that about 15, 16 years ago, starting off in healthcare. We were very fortunate to have a CEO, the one prior to me at the time, who knew to go get the right people. And we hired a firm and have been with them. And between their consulting fees and travel and all the other expenses, we spent about $2 million on this certification, seven credentials in particular, over the last 15 years or so. Much of that money went to getting great guidance. We just felt that this profession would benefit from the certification. It brings some credibility to the profession. It brings credibility to individuals. It gives some comfort to employers that their people have the credential. About 9,000 people now have one of the seven credentials. The process went something like this, and the process is very important. And under the guidance of a company called AMP, Applied Measurement Professionals, we were able to do it in a way that hundreds, if not thousands, have done it before us and create a legally defensible certification. And basically, it starts out with gathering people in the profession who not only know how to run a compliance program and what the role of the compliance officer is, but had spent years with other professionals in the profession so that they were able to represent the profession as opposed to what they knew. And so these people got together with AMP, and the first thing they did was think of every possible thing a compliance and ethics officer might do. And it turned out to be about 400 specific tasks that they might do. Then that was turned into a survey and sent out to compliance professionals, and a few hundred, I don't remember how many, filled out that, and they said, yes or no, I don't do this. And so when it came back, we were able to say, these are the tasks that are currently a part of the job. And the reason why that's really important is a lot of people think, well, I'll just go get 10 experts and we'll tell them what the job is. Well, that's not what you're testing. You're not saying to an employer that we gave this person the CCEP, Certified Compliance and Ethics Professional thing, because 10 people who think they know what they're talking about think this is the job. We're saying that of all the people that have this job out there, this is what they do. And we're certifying that they scored high enough to pass, or they didn't pass, a test related to the things that the job is. Not what it was, not what it should be, but what it is. Subsequent to that, every 4 years or so, we redo that job analysis survey and make sure that the test stays current with the current job. Then just an absolutely brutal process ensues after that, where this same group of people sits and tries to write multiple choice questions and get a pool of what has eventually become 500 questions for a 100 question test that will be different every time but relevant. Not everybody gets the exact same test, but all the questions are relatively the same. And that, I got to tell you, I sat through a lot of those meetings, and writing a question is harder than you think, and writing one correct answer and three kind of correct, not obviously wrong, but wrong It's just brutal. And there are about a dozen rules you just can't break. The longest answer can't be the right answer. Three words from the question can't be in the answer. There's all kinds of mistakes people make when they're writing test questions that give away the answer to crafty people. I can assure you, if I'd have known all this stuff before I went to high school, I would have gotten one full letter grade better, because not only did I not know all the tricks, I succumbed to the tricks of misleading inaccurate questions. And then probably the most beautiful piece of this, and by the way, the people at AMP are called, the people you work with, the lead folks are called psychometricians. It's a really cool word, which just simply means a person who understands.
I thought you were going to say hamsters.
Well, we all look like hamsters, I'll tell you, because, by the way, I didn't say this. Don't let me forget to get back to psychometricians. But not only do you write these questions, you put these questions, we write, and then when people are just burned out from writing, they're entering them as we write them, turn them in. And the psychometrician who's leading the little session puts them up on the screen after we get burned out, and then we start evaluating other people's questions. And I'm telling you, man, that is a brutal, brutal process, because for a question to get through the gauntlet of your peers is just really hard. You could write one that you think is beautiful, stone cold lock, and they will tear it apart. But the beautiful thing is sometimes you have to throw it out. It's just such a mess. But other times it gets refined and refined. And how we do doesn't really matter. It's under the auspice or the oversight of this psychometrician, which, by the way, is a statistician and a testing expert rolled into one. And we got to get through the gauntlet of your peers, the gauntlet of the psychometrician. But eventually statistics just don't lie. They do statistical analysis on the questions before they're used. Now, in the first 50 people you test, you don't have this luxury. But for all thousands of people after that, you were able to put in some test questions every time they took a test. Didn't count, but we evaluated the results and we looked for problems. And one problem that I just love, this problem, is a question would get kicked out if people who scored in the 90th percentile got it wrong 90% of the time. In other words, it's a highly suspect question because the people who scored the highest got it wrong. And what was fun is you'd look at it and everybody on occasion would just smile and go, that's the question that separates 90th from 100. It's solid. It's okay. And half the time they would say, I can see how this is not clear. We need to fix it. So before it ever got used for real, it goes through this analysis. And another example of one that might be a little faulty is A, B, and C are picked 33% of the time equally, or some other statistic. It's just these guys are amazing how they analyze these and pull them out, and we either look at it and go, aha, we got a little problem, we need to change the wording and whatnot. So anyways, people have to have a certain amount of work experience to sit for the exam. They have to have a certain amount of current education, CEUs, just like CLEs for lawyers. They have to sit for the exam. They have to pass the exam. If they don't pass the exam, there's a period at which they can retake it. There's all sorts of other information, and there's a handbook on all these details. But the thing that I would want to express is that a lot of work went into it. A lot of money went into it. I think our profession should be very proud of it. It's now being used around the world. There's about 700 people, I'm not really sure the exact number, that have the CCEPI. It's an international certification. I think there's another 300 that have the CCEP that don't live in the United States. It might be about 1,000 people outside the U.S. It's becoming respected elsewhere. If you go into Indeed.com and type in the word compliance and CCEP, you'll see 100 jobs that listed as required or preferred. Where it's been around longer, like in healthcare for 15 years, the last survey we did, and we haven't done it for a long time, but 80% either required or preferred it. People sometimes, in closing, I will say this, some people say, well, how do I know it's legitimate? And I go, you know what? Like, does the government endorse it or whatever? And I go, that's not how it works. I can't tell you it's legitimate. The government can't tell you it's legitimate. What has to happen is the profession and HR departments and employers and people hiring have to say it's legitimate. So if you see it in job postings, if you see people respecting it in other ways, it has arrived. So if you're ever doing research on a certification in any profession, I'd ask the process, some of which I covered. I skipped a lot. But I hit some important stuff. But it is, you've got to go out and look and see what the profession thinks of it. 9,000 people have one of these. I kind of like to think that means the profession has embraced it. A lot of job postings by HR departments who don't even know a compliance professional have researched and found the certification and used it in their job posting. And so they kind of think it's good. And eventually, I think more and more leadership will come to respect this particular one. A lot of them already do, in the sense that they'll say, is there a credential in your field? I'd like you to go research it, and I'd like you to get it. We've had people call up in a panic. I'm applying for a job, but they want this certification. I got to get it right now. And I go, well, you know, there's a process, you know, and right. It doesn't happen overnight. So that's probably too much about it all, but it's exciting. One other thing, a couple of myths I'd like to clarify. One is some people imply that you have to have our education to, like, go to an academy or the annual meeting or whatever. You don't have to get any of your CEUs from us, not a single stinking one. Any education that anybody gets anywhere that is relevant to a compliance and ethics professional, and given how broad the world of regulations are, and ethics and auditing and monitoring and hotline, I mean, there is countless things every day out there that you could do, some of it for free. Consulting firms, audit firms, law firms provide free education in this field. You can get it anywhere. The cost, and I'm not really the right one to tell you what the current cost, but it's like $250 for a member, $350 for a non-member to sit for the exam. You don't have to go to any of our education. You go to H&R Block all over the country and take the exam. You got to document your previous education and your previous job experience. You got to apply, and it has to be approved. But it's really important to understand that this is a certification of the profession, by the profession, for the profession. It's not tied to the revenue stream of any organization. There's an independent certification board headed by Debbie Trochlis, who's been doing this for years, to make decisions about how the certification ought to be managed. There's a way to do this right. We've studied it, and we think we get a lot of it right. Sorry, Tom. This thing is, to me, is really important to our profession. I get a little gabby there.
So what are some of the things that a person can do to prepare for the examination? You talked about the academies. You talked about
it's a great question.
Going to either the annual conference or regional conferences, or perhaps industry-specific conferences, but what are some of the things people do to prepare themselves for the examination?
I'm going to be real careful here, but I do have to say that I've watched these people develop this academy for the last 15 years. We have several different academies, four or five. I think it's the best compliance training. And basically, by the way, this academy and the test and all these things, they cover the role of the compliance officer and the function of the compliance program. There's a little bit of question about the rule of law and risk areas and things like that, but it's primarily, we're certifying, not people understand the rule of law, we're certifying that people understand the function of a compliance program and the role of a compliance officer. I had an attorney once call me up. I sat for exam and I flunked it, and your exam is garbage, you know. And I'm an attorney, and I've been in the field 20 years, and you don't know what you're doing. And I thought, well, now you know. Now you know that this exam doesn't. It's not the bar exam. It's about how to run a compliance program and the function of the compliance officer. The best way to prepare is to be in the field. Now, there are other ways to learn and study, and books and conferences, and there are conferences that are not related to our organization that are fine, and many publications that are out there, blogs, podcasts. Yes, you know, a lot of what you do is stuff that people could read and benefit from and probably do better on the test. Here's my point. This is maybe the golden point. If this test or any certification test like it. It doesn't test that you read a book. It doesn't test that you took the academy. It doesn't test these sorts of things. It tests that you know the subject. In other words, let's say there's somebody who's been in compliance for 5 years, and they go to H&R Block and they take the exam and they pass it. And somebody goes, well, you didn't spend all this money. You didn't go to all these academies. No, but it's testing me if I understand the job and the function of compliance program. Doesn't matter where I got it and where I received that knowledge. So, you know, to answer your question very specifically, I would get a good compliance book or two, maybe the ones that are more to the point and are not, you know, 1,000 pages or whatever, and read them and reread them. There's a couple short ones out there. I'd just rather not mention any more names. Do your research. And
you can read my book, Doing Compliance. I'll throw a plug in.
Absolutely. And while Marty Beagleman wrote a book on sure. World-Class Compliance Program, Grant Hart wrote How to Be a Wildly Successful Compliance Officer. Okay, you could read all this stuff or focus on, get one that you think's the best, maybe hit it a couple times. I just personally think that that's a better way to learn. Conferences are just terrific, in my opinion. It's just a great way to learn. And some of our conferences, like the annual meeting, we'll actually list which ones are the sessions that I would go to that are related to the role of the compliance officer and the function of the compliance program. So you can see a little asterisk there. But you don't need it. You can go to any conference and pick out the sessions like compliance for beginners or 101 or how to do an audit, how to do a risk assessment. And then, you know, trying to have some fun studying. Social media can be a lot more interesting than we have blogs. Everybody, you know, there's a lot of blogs and there's a lot of LinkedIn groups. And just when you can't do your job anymore, you need a break. You need 15 minutes to refresh and you want to do something legitimate for your employer. Pop on and see what people are talking about at the moment. And immerse yourself in the field. Spend time in the field. This test should prove that you are qualified to do this job. Well, what's the best way to be qualified for a job? Be in it for a while. My answer is not going to be a book or a class or a speech or a whatever. My answer is, if this test is done right, which I believe it has been, it tests whether you know the material or not. How you get it? There's lots of ways. But if you want, a lot of people want to tune up. Go to a conference, go to academy, read a book over and over. I would go do that, but really, you should pass it if you know it, and you will pass it if you know it. And if you haven't spent any time with the profession, you're going to have a hard time passing it, even if you go to spend all kinds of money with anybody.
Roy, unfortunately, we're near the end of our time, so we'll have to continue our conversation on unfair and unbalanced at a later time. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom.